rose to over 500,000 men on the ground and appeared to be attaining some success in grinding the enemy down by sheer weight and mass, although at horrendous cost, in the words of the pacification chief, Robert Blowtorch Comer, later to become a high-ranking official of the Human Rights Administration. By 1967, the popular mood was shifting, and the public was beginning to defy the hawk-dove consensus of elites for whom the issues were limited to tactics and expedience, a matter of much government concern. Defense Secretary McNamara warned the president in secret in May 1967 that expansion of the American war might polarize opinion to the extent that doves in the U.S. will get out of hand, massive refusals to serve or to fight or to cooperate, or worse. At the time of the Tet Offensive, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were concerned with our capacity to meet the possibility of widespread civil disorder in the months ahead. In considering further troop deployments, they took care to ensure that sufficient forces are still available for civil disorder control, including National Guard forces deployed under state or federal control and U.S. Army troops. The Pentagon warned further that a request for more troops might lead to increased defiance of the draft and growing unrest in the cities, running the risk of provoking a domestic crisis of unprecedented proportions. Earlier, the Pentagon feared that escalation of the land war between South Vietnam might lead to massive civil disobedience, particularly in view of opposition to the war among young people, the underprivileged, women, and segments of the intelligentsia. The sight of thousands of peaceful demonstrators being confronted by troops in battle gear during the massive anti-war demonstration and massive march on the Pentagon in October 1967 was particularly disturbing, the Pentagon Papers analyst observed. The gradual withdrawal of the increasingly demoralized U.S. military forces led to a diminution of visible protest by the early 1970s, but the Vietnam syndrome was never cured. As late as 1982, 72% of the public, but far fewer opinion makers, and, to judge by other evidence cited earlier, virtually none of the American intellectual elite, regarded the Vietnam War as more than a mistake. It was fundamentally wrong and immoral, a disparity between the public and its leaders that persists as of 1986. The primary task facing the ideological institutions in the post-war period was to convince the errant public that the war was less a moral crime than the thunderously stupid military blunder of throwing 500,000 ground troops into an unwinnable war. As the respected New York Times war correspondent Homer Bigart explained, while chastising Gloria Emerson for her unwillingness to adopt this properly moderate view, the purpose of the war must be perceived as preventing North Vietnam from subjugating South Vietnam, John Midgley, the real enemy, of course, being North Vietnam, supplied and sustained by the Soviet Union and China, Drew Middleton, all in defiance of the plain facts. The primary issue was the cost to the United States in its noble endeavor. Thus, Robert Nisbet describes the intellectual pleasure he derived from a truly distinguished work of history with the chapter covering the 1960s, with emphasis on the Vietnam War and its devastating impact upon Americans, obviously the only victims worthy of concern. To persuade elite opinion was never much of a problem, since these were the reigning conceptions throughout, and clearly privilege, along with media access, accrues to those who follow this path. But the public has nevertheless remained corrupted. An ancillary task has been to keep the devastation that the United States left as its legacy in Indochina hidden from public view. Indeed, one finds only scattered reference to this not entirely trivial matter in the U.S. media, a remarkable achievement given the agency of destruction and its scale. Keeping just to Vietnam, the death toll may have passed 3 million. In an article entitled "Studies Show Vietnam Raids Failed," Charles Moore observes that the CIA estimated deaths from bombing of the North at well over 30,000 a year by 1967, heavily weighted with civilians. Crop destruction programs from 1961 had a devastating impact, including aerial destruction by chemicals, ground operations to destroy orchards and dikes, and land clearing by giant tractors, Rome plows, that obliterated agricultural lands, often including extensive systems of paddy dikes and entire rural residential areas and farming hamlets, leaving the soil bare, gray, and lifeless, in the words of an official report cited by Arthur Westing, who compares the operations to the less efficient destruction of Carthage during the Punic Wars. The combined ecological, economic, and social consequences of the wartime defoliation operations have been vast and will take several generations to reverse. In the empty landscapes of South Vietnam, recovery will be long delayed, if at all possible, and there is no way to estimate the human effects of the chemical poison dioxin at levels 300 to 400% greater than the average levels obtaining among exposed groups in North America. In the South, 9,000 out of 15,000 hamlets were damaged or destroyed, along with some 25 million acres of farmland and 12 million acres of forest. 1.5 million cattle were killed, and the war left 1 million widows and some 800,000 orphans. In the North, all 6 industrial cities were damaged, 3 razed to the ground, along with 28 of 30 provincial towns, 12 completely destroyed, 96 of 116 district towns, and 4,000 of some 5,800 communes. 400,000 cattle were killed, and over 1 million acres of farmland were damaged. Much of the land is a moonscape, where people live on the edge of famine, with rice rations lower than those in Bangladesh. Reviewing the environmental effects, the Swedish Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, concludes that the ecological debilitation from such attack is likely to be of long duration. The respected Swiss-based environmental group IUCN, International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources, concluded that the ecology is not only refusing to heal, but is worsening, so that a catastrophe may result unless billions of dollars are spent to reconstruct the land that has been destroyed, a monumental task that could be addressed only if the United States were to offer substantial reparations, a possibility that cannot be considered in a cultural climate of abysmal ignorance, chauvinism, and the self-righteous pursuit of self-interest. Destruction of forests has increased the frequency of floods and droughts and aggravated the impact of typhoons, and war damage to dikes, some of which in the South were completely destroyed by U.S. bombardment, and other agricultural systems has yet to be repaired. The report notes that humanitarian and conservationist groups, particularly in the United States, have encountered official resistance and red tape when requesting their government's authorization to send assistance to Vietnam. Naturally enough, since the United States remains committed to ensure that its achievements are not threatened by recovery of the countries it destroyed. There is little hint of any of this, or of the similar Carthaginian devastation in Laos and Cambodia, in mainstream U.S. media coverage. Rather, with remarkable uniformity and self-righteousness, the problems of reconstruction, hampered further by the natural catastrophes and continuing war to which the United States has made what contribution it can, are attributed solely to communist brutality and ineptitude. The sole remaining interest in post-war Vietnam in the U.S. media has been the recovery of remains of U.S. personnel presumed to be killed in action, the Vietnamese preoccupation with other matters serving as further proof of their moral insensitivity. In one of his sermons on human rights, President Carter explained that we owe Vietnam no debt and have no responsibility to render it any assistance because the destruction was mutual. A statement that elicited no comment to our knowledge apart from our own, a fact that speaks volumes about the prevailing cultural climate. Some feel that there may once have been a debt, but that it has been amply repaid. Under the headline, "The Debt to the Indochinese is Becoming a Fiscal Drain," Bernard Gwertzman quotes a State Department official who said he believed the United States has now paid its moral debt for its involvement on the losing side in Indochina. The remark, which also passed without comment, is illuminating. We owe no debt for mass slaughter and for leaving 3 countries in ruins, no debt to the millions of maimed and orphaned, to the peasants who still die today from exploding ordnance left from the U.S. assault. Rather, our moral debt results only from the fact that we did not win. By this logic, If the Russians win in Afghanistan, they will have no moral debt at all. Proceeding further, how have we paid our moral debt for failing to win? By resettling Vietnamese refugees fleeing the lands we ravaged, one of the largest, most dramatic humanitarian efforts in history, according to Roger Winter, director of the U.S. Committee for Refugees. But despite the pride, Quertzman continues, some voices in the Reagan administration and in Congress are once again asking whether the war debt has now been paid. The media are not satisfied with mutual destruction, that it faces all responsibility for some of the major war crimes of the modern era. Rather, the perpetrator of the crimes must be seen as the injured party. We find headlines reading, "Vietnam, trying to be nicer, still has a long way to go. It's about time the Vietnamese demonstrated some goodwill," said Charles Prince of Human Rights Advocates International, referring to negotiations about the Amerasian children who constitute a tiny fraction of the victims of U.S. aggression in Indochina. Barbara Crossett adds that the Vietnamese have also not been sufficiently forthcoming on the matter of remains of American soldiers, although their behavior may be improving. There has been progress, albeit slow, on the missing Americans. The unresolved problem of the war is what they did to us, since we were simply defending ourselves from internal aggression in Vietnam. It surely makes sense to consider ourselves the victims of the Vietnamese. In a derisive account of Vietnamese laments over the failure of the United States to improve relations with them, Barbara Crossett reports their continuing exaggeration of Vietnam's importance to Americans under the headline, "For Vietnamese, realism is in short supply." The Vietnamese do not comprehend their irrelevance, she explains with proper imperial contempt. U.S. interest in Vietnam, she continues, is limited to the natural American outrage over Hanoi's invasion of Cambodia to overthrow our current ally, Pol Pot, and its failure to be sufficiently forthcoming on the issue of American servicemen missing since the end of the war. She cites a Pentagon statement noting that Vietnam has agreed to return the remains of 20 more servicemen and expressing the hope that the communists will proceed to resolve this long-standing humanitarian issue. She quotes an Asian official as saying that we all know they have the bones somewhere. If Hanoi's leaders are serious about building their country, the Vietnamese will have to deal fairly with the United States. When a Vietnamese official suggested that the U.S. send food aid to regions where starving villagers are being asked to spend their time and energy searching for the remains of American pilots killed while destroying their country, State Department spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley reacted with great anger. "We are outraged at any suggestion of linking food assistance with the return of remains," she declaimed. So profound is the U.S. commitment to humanitarian imperatives and moral values that it cannot permit these lofty ideals to be tainted by associating them with such trivial concerns and indecent requests. It is difficult to know how to react to a cultural climate in which such words can be spoken, evoking no reaction. According to standard state and media doctrine, South Vietnam, that is, the client regime that we established, lost the war to North Vietnam, the official enemy, since the U.S. attack against the South cannot be conceded. North Vietnam, not the Viet Cong, was always the enemy, John Corey proclaims in reporting the basic message of an NBC white paper on the war, a stance that is conventional in the mainstream. Corey is indignant that anyone should question this higher truth. As proof of the absurdity of such liberal mythology, he cites the Battle of Ya Drang Valley in November 1965. It was clear then that North Vietnam was in the war. Nonetheless, liberal mythology insisted that the war was being waged only by the Viet Cong, mostly righteous peasants. Corey presents no example of liberals who described the Viet Cong as righteous peasants, there being none, and no example of anyone who denied that North Vietnamese troops had entered the South by November 1965, since again, there were none. Furthermore, opponents of the war at that time and for several years after included few representatives of mainstream liberalism. Corey's argument for North Vietnamese aggression, however, is as impressive as any that has been presented. The NBC white paper was one of a rash of retrospectives on the 10th anniversary of the war's end, devoted to the war that went wrong, the lessons it taught. These retrospective assessments provide considerable insight into the prevailing intellectual culture. Their most striking feature is what is missing, the American Wars in Indochina. It is a classic example of Hamlet without the Prince of Denmark. Apart from a few scattered sentences, the rare allusions to the war in these lengthy presentations, as in post-war commentary rather generally, including cinema and literature as well as the media, are devoted to the suffering of the American invaders. The Wall Street Journal, for example, refers to the $180 million in chemical companies' compensation to Agent Orange victims, U.S. soldiers, not the South Vietnamese victims whose suffering was and remains vastly greater. It is difficult to exaggerate the significance of these startling facts. There is an occasional glimpse of reality. Time opens its inquiry by recalling the trauma of the American soldiers facing an enemy that dissolved by day into the villages, into the other Vietnamese. They maddened the Americans with the mystery of who they were, the unseen man who shot from the tree line or laid a wire across the trail with the Claymore mine at the other end, the mama-san who did the wash, the child concealing a grenade. No doubt one could find similar complaints in the Nazi press about the Balkans. The meaning of these facts is almost never perceived. Time goes so far as to claim that the subversion was orchestrated by Moscow so that the United States had to send troops to defend South Vietnam, echoing the fantasies concocted in scholarship. For example, by Walt Rostow, who maintains that in his effort to gain the balance of power in Eurasia, Stalin turned to the East to back Mao and to inflame the North Korean and Indochinese communists. Throughout the war, elite groups remained loyal to the cause. Apart from expressing qualms about the bombing of North Vietnam, which was regarded as problematic since it might lead to a broader conflict, drawing in China and the USSR, from which the United States might not be immune. This was the toughest question, according to the McNamara memo cited earlier, and the only serious question among respectable critics of the war. The massacre of innocents is a problem only among emotional or irresponsible types, or among the aging adolescents on college faculties who found it rejuvenating to play revolution. Decent and respectable people remain silent and obedient, devoting themselves to personal gain, concerned only that we too might ultimately face unacceptable threat, a stance not without historical precedent. In contrast to the war protesters, two commentators explain, decent patriotic Americans demanded, and in the person of Ronald Reagan have apparently achieved, a return to pride and patriotism, a reaffirmation of the values and virtues that had been trampled upon by the Vietnam-spawned counterculture. Most crucially, the virtues of marching in parades, chanting praises for their leaders as they conduct their necessary chores, as in Indochina and El Salvador. The extent of this servility is revealed throughout the 10th anniversary retrospectives, not only by the omission of the war itself, but also by the interpretation provided. The New York Times writes sardonically of the ignorance of the American people, only 60% of whom are aware that the United States sided with South Vietnam, as Nazi Germany sided with France, as the USSR now sides with Afghanistan. Given that we were engaged in a defense of freedom in South Vietnam, Charles Krauthammer, it must be that the critics of this noble if flawed enterprise sided with Hanoi, and that is indeed what Standard Doctrine maintains. The fact that opposition to American aggression in South Vietnam, or even against the North, entails no such support. Just as opposition to Soviet aggression entails no support for either the feudalist forces of the Afghan resistance or Pakistan or the United States is an elementary point that inevitably escapes the mind of the well-indoctrinated intellectual. The Times retrospective alleges that North Vietnam was portrayed by some American intellectuals as the repository of moral rectitude. No examples are given, nor is evidence presented to support these charges, and the actual record is, as always, scrupulously ignored. Critics of the peace movement are quoted expounding on its moral failure of terrifying proportions, and several former peace activists who had leaped across the ideological divide and now are taking their stand with conservative Christians of the Reaganite variety are quoted at length. But those who are allegedly guilty of these terrifying crimes are given no opportunity to explain the basis for their opposition to U.S. aggression and massacre. Nor are they permitted to assign to their proper place in history those who condemn their moral failure of opposing U.S. aggression, or those who praise themselves for their occasional twitters of protest when the cost to us became too great. We read that the opponents of the war brandished moral principles and brushed aside complexity, but nothing of what they had to say, as was the case throughout the war. A current pretense is that principled critics of the war had access to the mainstream media during these years. In fact, they were almost entirely excluded, and now we are regaled with the accounts of their alleged crimes, but are almost never permitted to hear their actual words, exactly as one would expect in a properly functioning system of indoctrination with the task of preserving privilege and authority from critical analysis. The Times informs us that Vietnam now stands exposed as the Prussia of Southeast Asia, because since 1975 they have unleashed a series of pitiless attacks against their neighbors, referring to the Vietnamese invasion that overthrew the Pol Pot regime after 2 years of border attacks from Cambodia, the regime that we now support despite pretenses to the contrary. Although the Times is outraged at the Prussian-style aggression that overthrew our current Khmer Rouge ally and at the Vietnamese insistence that a political settlement must exclude Pol Pot, the reader of its pages will find little factual material about any of these matters. There are, incidentally, countries that have unleashed a series of pitiless attacks against their neighbors in these years. For example, Israel with its invasions of Lebanon in 1978 and 1982. But as an American client state, Israel inherits the right of aggression, so it does not merit the bitter criticism Vietnam deserves for overthrowing Pol Pot. And in any event, Israel's invasion of Lebanon was a liberation, as the Times explained at the time, always carefully excluding Lebanese opinion on the matter as obviously irrelevant. The Times recognizes that the United States did suffer shame during its Indochina wars, the shame of defeat. Victory, we are to assume, would not have been shameful, and the record of aggression and atrocities generally supported by the Times evokes no shame. Rather, the United States thought it was resisting communists when it intervened in Indochina. How we resist the natives defending their homes from our attack, the Times does not explain. That the United States lost the war in Indochina is an inescapable fact, Wall Street Journal, repeated without question throughout the retrospectives and in American commentary generally. The truth is more complex, although to see why, it is necessary to escape the confines of the propaganda system and to investigate the rich documentary record that lays out the planning and motives for the American wars in Indochina over 30 years. This record shows that a rather different conclusion is in order, an important fact to understand. The United States did not achieve its maximal goals in Indochina, but it did gain a partial victory. Despite talk by Eisenhower and others about Vietnamese raw materials, the primary U.S. concern was not Indochina, but rather the domino effect, the demonstration effect of independent development that might cause the rot to spread to Thailand and beyond, perhaps ultimately drawing Japan into a new order from which the United States would be excluded. This threat was averted as the United States proceeded to teach the lesson that a war of liberation is costly, dangerous, and doomed to failure, Kennedy advisor General Maxwell Taylor testifying to Congress. The countries of Indochina will be lucky to survive. They will not endanger global order by social and economic success in a framework that denies the West the freedom to exploit, infecting regions beyond, as has been feared. It might parenthetically be noted that although this interpretation of the American aggression is supported by substantial evidence, there is no hint of its existence in the popular histories or the retrospectives, for such ideas do not conform to the required image of aggrieved benevolence. Again, we see here the operation of the Orwellian principle that ignorance is strength. While proceeding to extirpate the rot of successful independent development in Indochina, the United States moved forcefully to buttress the second line of defense. In 1965, the United States backed a military coup in Indonesia, the most important domino short of Japan, while American liberals and Freedom House lauded the dramatic changes that took place there, the most dramatic being the massacre of hundreds of thousands of landless peasants and the destruction of the only mass-based political party, as a proof that we were right to defend South Vietnam by demolishing it, thus encouraging the Indonesian generals to prevent any rot from spreading there. In 1972, the United States backed the overthrow of Philippine democracy, thus averting the threat of national capitalism there with a terror and torture state on the preferred Latin American model. A move toward democracy in Thailand in 1973 evoked some concern, prompting a reduction in economic aid and increase in military aid in preparation for the military coup that took place with U.S. support in 1976. Thailand has had a particularly important role in the U.S. regional system since 1954, when the National Security Council laid out a plan for subversion and eventual aggression throughout Southeast Asia in response to the Geneva Accords, with Thailand serving as its focal point and, subsequently, as a major base for the U.S. attacks on Vietnam and Laos. In his personal Times retrospective, Pentagon Papers director Leslie Gelb observes that 10 years after the war ended, the position of the United States in Asia is stronger than at any time since World War II, despite the defeat of South Vietnam, quoting policy analysts from government and scholarship who observed that Thailand and Indonesia were able to get themselves together politically, economically, and militarily to beat down communist insurgencies, in the manner just indicated, as were the Philippines and South Korea, also graced with a U.S.-backed military coup in 1972. The business press had drawn the same conclusions years earlier during the latter stages of the war. In short, the United States won a regional victory and even a substantial local victory in Indochina, left in ruins. The U.S. victory was particularly significant within South Vietnam, where the peasant-based revolutionary forces were decimated and the rural society was demolished. One hardcore revolutionary district just outside Saigon, Cu Chi, Paul Quinn Judge observes, sent 16,000 men and women to fight for the National Liberation Front. Some 9,900 did not return. Much the same was true throughout the South. The deaths left a major political gap for the new regime, he adds. The South was stripped of the trained, disciplined, and presumably committed young cadres who would have formed the backbone of the present administration. In many areas, the losses were near complete, and the casualties put further strains on the state's limited financial and organization capacities. The U.S. victory over the overwhelmingly rural society of South Vietnam, always the primary enemy, laid the basis for the takeover by North Vietnam, as anticipated years earlier in the much-derided peace movement literature, allowing American hypocrites to prove that this predictable consequence of the war they supported shows that it was a just defense of South Vietnam against northern aggressors. In the cities, swollen with millions of refugees, the lucky and the more corrupt survived on an American dole at a level that had no relation to the now demolished productive capacity of the country, leaving another near insoluble problem that can conveniently be blamed on the communists. The revolutionary forces had gained victory in many rural areas by the time of the outright U.S. invasion, largely through their appeal to the peasantry, as documented in the more serious scholarly work from sources in or close to the U.S. government. But many of the conclusions of this work have been invalidated by the events after Tet, New York Times Asia correspondent Fox Butterfield observes, a coy reference to the fact that this political success was overturned by the U.S. outburst of savagery in the post-Tet mass murder operations. That the United States suffered a defeat in Indochina is a natural perception on the part of those of limitless ambition, who understand defeat to mean the achievement only of major goals, while certain minor ones remain beyond our grasp. The perception of an unqualified U.S. defeat in the media perspectives and similar commentary is understandable in part in these terms, in part in terms of the alleged goal of defending freedom developed in official propaganda and relayed by the ideological institutions. Post-war U.S. policy has been designed to ensure that the victory is maintained by maximizing suffering and oppression in Indochina, which then evokes further gloating here. Since the destruction is mutual, as is readily demonstrated by a stroll through New York, Boston, Vin, Quang Nai Province, and the Plain of Jars, we are entitled to deny reparations, aid, and trade, and to block development funds. The extent of U.S. sadism is noteworthy, as is the null reaction to it. In 1977, when India tried to send 100 buffalo to Vietnam to replenish the herds destroyed by U.S. violence, the United States threatened to cancel food for peace aid, while the press featured photographs of peasants in Cambodia pulling plows as proof of communist barbarity. The photographs in this case were probably fabrications of Thai intelligence, but authentic ones could no doubt have been obtained throughout Indochina. The Carter administration even denied rice to Laos, despite a cynical pretense to the contrary, where the agricultural system was destroyed by U.S. terror bombing. Oxfam America was not permitted to send 10 solar pumps to Cambodia for irrigation in 1983. In 1981, the U.S. government sought to block a shipment of school supplies and educational kits to Cambodia by the Mennonite Church. A tiny report in the Christian Science Monitor observes that the United States is blocking international shipments of food to Vietnam during a post-war famine, using the food weapon to punish Vietnam for its occupation of Cambodia, according to diplomatic sources. 2 days later, Times correspondent Henry Kam concluded his tour of duty as chief Asian diplomatic correspondent with a long article in which he comments sadly on the considerably reduced quality of life in Indochina, where in Vietnam even working animals are rare, for unexplained reasons, in contrast to the continuing rise, however uneven in many aspects, of the standard of living elsewhere in the region. In 35 paragraphs, he manages to produce not one word on the effects of the U.S. war or the post-war policy of bleeding Vietnam, as the Far Eastern Economic Review accurately terms it. The major television retrospective on the war was the award-winning 13-part PBS Television History of 1983, produced with the cooperation of British and French television, followed by a Vietnam op-ed in 1985 that included the accuracy in media critique and discussion of the two documentaries by a group tilted heavily toward the Hawks. The controversy had well-defined bounds. At one extreme, there were those who defended the PBS series as fair and accurate. At the other, critics who claimed that it presented a war of the good nationalists represented by Ho Chi Minh versus the evil imperialist Americans who are trying to quash, sit on, the legitimate aspirations of the South Vietnamese people, AIM Chairman Reed Irvine. The moderator, the man in the middle, concluded the discussion by stressing the importance of allowing conflicting views about the Vietnam War to be presented at a time when the nation as a whole is finally allowing itself a close look at the only war we have ever lost. We will not review the AIM critique or the debate, which reiterates many of the charges we have already discussed. For example, Irvine's sole example of how the enemy was able to use our free, uncontrolled media to achieve their own objectives, namely, via the media's portrayal of the Tet Offensive as a defeat for our side, even though it was actually a very outstanding military victory. More to the point here are the contents of the PBS series itself, and the fact that it sets the bounds on critical analysis of the failed crusade undertaken for motives that were noble, although illusory, as the PBS Companion volume describes the U.S. effort to defend South Vietnam's independence. With regard to the American War, the PBS series makes a conscious effort to be balanced, to present all sides, to take no side. The French, in contrast, are treated far more harshly, as brutal colonialists, with no pretense of balance. Peter Biskind comments, "Whereas the narrator referred to Ho Chi Minh and his followers as rebels, nationalists, or the Vietnamese resistance, as long as they were fighting the French, once the Americans arrive, they are invariably communists, or just the enemy. Whereas Bao Dai is the playboy emperor picked by the French, Nguyen Cao Ky and Nguyen Van Thieu are simply the government. Whereas French troops just released from Japanese prison camps go on a rampage arresting and attacking Vietnamese, American troops engage in the was-it-or-wasn't-it massacre at Thuy Bo." The effort to maintain balance is illustrated, for example, in the narrator's concluding words to Episode 4, covering Johnson's escalation of the war in 1964-65 and the first appearance of North Vietnamese units in the South in mid-1965. After presenting Lyndon Johnson and other U.S. government spokesmen, the narrator states, "Johnson called it invasion. Hanoi called it liberation. In the fall of 1965, three North Vietnamese regiments massed in the Central Highlands. Nearly 2 years had passed since Johnson renewed the U.S. commitment to defend South Vietnam. Nearly 2 years had passed since Ho Chi Minh renewed his commitment to liberate the South. Now their two armies braced for battle. For the first time in the Battle of the Ya Drang Valley, Americans fought the North Vietnamese face to face. For the first time, B-52s supported troops in the field. And for the first time, to Americans, Vietnam meant a major new war." Here we have a balance, but of a special kind. One may believe with Johnson that North Vietnam is invading the South, or with Ho that North Vietnam is fighting to liberate the South. We may not believe, however, that the United States is invading South Vietnam, which, we learned two episodes later, it had been bombing since 1961. Rather, we must assume, as a given fact not subject to debate, that the U.S. commitment was to defend South Vietnam. To evaluate this effort at balance, we may observe that during the preceding summer, 1965, 5 months after the United States began the regular bombing of North Vietnam, the Pentagon estimated that the 60,000 U.S. troops then deployed faced an enemy combat force of 48,500, 97% of them South Vietnamese guerrillas, Viet Cong. A few months after the Ya Drang Valley battle in March 1966, the Pentagon reported 13,100 North Vietnamese forces in the South, along with 225,000 Viet Cong, facing 216,400 U.S. troops and 23,000 third country troops, mostly South Korean, in addition to 690,000 ARVN troops. Considering these facts and the earlier history, it would seem possible to imagine a point of view that departs from the framework established here, one that is furthermore plainly accurate. The United States was stepping up its attack against South Vietnam. But that goes beyond balance, which is construed similarly throughout, thus consigning the series to the familiar system of state propaganda on the most crucial and essential point, a position critical of foreign aggression, that is, the U.S. aggression that was plainly the central element of the war, is excluded as unthinkable, although it may be conceded that, to the communists in Hanoi, America's presence in the South was yet another act of foreign aggression. The NLF in the South has granted no opinion on the matter, and the episode ends with a ringing declaration by LBJ. It is not that the facts are entirely hidden. Thus, Episode 5, America Takes Charge, opens with a description by a GI of how the ARVN and the VC are the same people, the same race, the same culture, and yet one side seems to be chicken, and the other side seems to fight in the face of overwhelming disadvantages in what is clearly their country. A U.S. major discusses the problem in Binh Dinh province, which had never been really in friendly hands since 1946, but rather under VC control throughout, compelling the United States to resort to awesome firepower that turns heavy jungle into a moonscape. But the plain truth that such facts entail cannot be expressed or perceived. Balance is also preserved in an account from both sides of what happened in the village of Thuy Bo in January 1967, where British producer Martin Smith had been shown the site of what villagers claimed to be a My Lai-style massacre, one of many, they alleged, with 100 women and children killed. Fox Butterfield reports that in contrast to the balanced picture actually presented by PBS, the British participants in the series argued that the Marine attack on Thuy Bo should be labeled a war crime. This failure to maintain balance was in keeping with what a filmmaker involved in the project termed their more moralistic stance, anxious to accentuate the aspects of the war that were immoral at the expense of looking at it afresh, which would apparently exclude the more moralistic stance. In this episode, the Marines tell their story of an assault on a VC-defended village, and then the villagers, given 35 lines of the transcript to 90 for the Marines, tell their conflicting version of a Marine massacre of wounded and captured civilians. The sequence ends with a Marine describing what took place as a normal procedure, with burning them hooches down and digging the Vietnamese people out of holes with grenades and rifle fire and scattering animals, pigs and chickens around like we normally do, especially after 3 days in the field under brutal conditions. The account continues in the same vein. We hear that American aircraft dropped 6 times more bombs on South Vietnam than on the communist North, and that most of the enemy troops were native Southerners. But no conclusion is suggested, except that the purpose of the U.S. bombing in Vietnam, distributed in this curious manner and at twice the tonnage dropped on Germany and Japan in World War II, was to try to stop North Vietnam from sending soldiers and supplies to the South. Nevertheless, 140,000 made it through 1967, according to the U.S. government, about half the number of South Korean mercenaries and a small fraction of the Americans who were destroying South Vietnam. The Phoenix program of political assassination is justified at length by its director, William Colby, who denies that it was what it was, and for balance, some comments are added by critics in the military and by a civilian aid worker describing apparent random killing and torture. The post-Tet military operations are passed over in total silence. After Nixon's election in 1968, when these wholesale U.S. massacres began in full force, the war continued, we learn. The weapons were Viet Cong rockets. The victims were Da Nang civilians, killed by the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. After the breakdown of negotiations in October 1972, the North was again intransigent, we learn, namely in demanding that the agreements be signed, a fact ignored, and in South Vietnam too, the agreement was still unacceptable, the familiar evasion of U.S. responsibility. The terms of the January 1973 agreement are given, but with no indication that the U.S. government announced at once its intent to disregard them, as it did. Rather, we hear that to the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, the struggle had not ended, because Vietnam was still divided. The facts are quite different, as we have heard. They are indeed more accurately stated, although briefly, 2 episodes later, episode 12, although the U.S. role is suppressed except by implication. America was still committed to South Vietnam, the narrator says, without noting that this commitment to the GVN, identified with South Vietnam by the U.S. government and by PBS, is in explicit violation of the agreements signed in Paris. Whatever their views of the war, the narrator adds, most Americans now believe that the cost had been too great, particularly the cost of American lives. They believed that no more Americans should die for Vietnam. The only other Americans are those who thought it proper that more Americans should die for Vietnam. Americans were dying for Vietnam in the same sense in which Russian boys are dying for Afghanistan. But those who could perceive this fact, and who opposed the war not merely because the cost was too great, but because aggression is wrong, are excluded from the category of Americans. As in the media retrospectives, the anti-war movement is given short shrift. A few activists are quoted, but permitted to discuss only questions of tactics. Even Eugene McCarthy, plainly the favored anti-war figure in this presentation, says nothing except that, "I think the case is rather clear about what's wrong about our involvement," which is fair enough, since the media's favorite dove had never been a serious critic of the war and was to disappear quickly from the scene after failing to gain political power, thus demonstrating again where his commitments lay. James Fallows is permitted to describe the spirit of the times, to look for the painless way out, namely a physical deferment. In the real world, this was a position that hardly defined the spirit of the times, although it is a facet of this spirit that is far more acceptable to mainstream opinion than the principled and courageous resistance of many thousands of young people, an intolerable phenomenon and therefore erased from the record. As Peter Biskind observes, for all the attempt at balance, and despite the preference of the PBS series for doves over hawks, it is the right, not the left, that has set this film's political agenda, in conformity to elite opinion. Biskind concludes his review of the PBS series by stating, "The truth is that the war was a crime, not a tragedy. The tragedy is that this film lacks the conviction to say so." The same may be said about the retrospective commentary generally. The war was a tragic error, but not fundamentally wrong and immoral, as the overwhelming majority of the American people continued to believe, and surely not criminal aggression. The judgment that would be reached at once on similar evidence if the responsible agent were not the United States or an ally or client. Our point is not that the retrospectives failed to draw what seemed to us, as to much of the population, the obvious conclusions. The more significant and instructive point is that principled objection to the war as fundamentally wrong and immoral, or as outright criminal aggression, a war crime, is inexpressible. It is not part of the spectrum of discussion. The background for such a principled critique cannot be developed in the media, and the conclusions cannot be drawn. It is not present even to be refuted. Rather, the idea is unthinkable. All of this again reveals with great clarity how foreign to the mobilized media is a conception of the media as a free system of information and discussion independent of state authority and elite interests. Chapter 6. The Indochina Wars. 2. Laos and Cambodia. The Geneva Accords of 1954 provided a political settlement in Laos and Cambodia. Both countries, however, were drawn into the U.S. attack on Indochina with devastating consequences. In both cases, the media made a noteworthy contribution to this outcome. 6.1. Laos. In Laos, as in Vietnam, the United States undertook to prevent a political settlement, as described frankly in congressional hearings by Ambassador Graham Parsons, who stated that, "I struggled for 16 months to prevent a coalition." A U.S. military mission was established under civilian cover in violation of the Geneva Accords, headed by a general in civilian guise, and U.S. aid followed in an effort to establish U.S. control. A measure of its scale and purposes is given by the fact that Laos was the only country in the world where the United States supports the military budget 100%. Nevertheless, a coalition government was established in 1958 after the only elections worthy of the name in the history of Laos. Despite extensive U.S. efforts, they were won handily by the left. 9 of the 13 candidates of the Pathet Lao guerrillas won seats in the National Assembly, along with 4 candidates from the left-leaning neutralists, fellow travelers, as they were called by Ambassador Parsons. These communists or fellow travelers won 13 of the 21 seats contested. The largest vote went to the leader of the Pathet Lao, Prince Suphanuvong, who was elected chairman of the National Assembly. U.S. pressures, including crucially the withdrawal of aid, quickly led to the overthrow of the government in a coup by a pro-Western neutralist who pledged his allegiance to the free world and declared his intention to disband the political party of the Pathet Lao, Neo Lao Hak Sot, or NLHS, scrapping the agreements that had successfully established the coalition. He was overthrown in turn by the CIA favorite, the ultra-right-wing general Pau Me Nosavong. After U.S. clients won the 1960 elections, rigged so crudely that even the most pro-U.S. observers were appalled, civil war broke out, with the USSR and China backing a coalition extending over virtually the entire political spectrum apart from the extreme right, which was backed by the United States. The U.S. government assessment was that by the spring of 1961, the NLHS appeared to be in a position to take over the entire country, primarily because of its control of the countryside, where it had diligently built up an organization covering most of the country's 10,000 villages, as noted ruefully by the bitterly anti-communist Australian journalist Dennis Warner. The problem was a familiar one. The United States and its clients were militarily strong, but politically weak. Recognizing that its policies were in a shambles, the United States agreed to take part in a new Geneva conference, which proposed a new settlement in 1962. This, too, quickly broke down, and the Civil War resumed with a different lineup and with increasing intervention by the United States and its allies, and by North Vietnam, in the context of the expanding war in Vietnam. U.S. clandestine military operations began in 1961, and the regular U.S. bombing began in early 1964. Operation Barrel Roll, directed against northern Laos, was initiated in December 1964, several months before the regular bombing of North Vietnam. The bombing of northern Laos was intensified in 1966, reaching extraordinary levels from 1968 with the bombing halt in North Vietnam. In reality, a bombing redistribution, the planes being shifted to the destruction of Laos. Media coverage of Laos during the early period was sometimes extensive, over three times as great as of Vietnam in the New York Times in 1961, the Pentagon Papers analyst observes, but its contents were often absurd. For example, the aid cutoff that was the essential factor in the U.S. subversion of the elected government of Laos in 1958 was never even reported in the national press, which barely mentioned the events, and then with misleading commentary reflecting Washington deceit. Bernard Fall gave a detailed and derisive exposure of some of the more ludicrous incidents, including inflammatory fabrications that helped create major crises and led to deeper U.S. involvement in Thailand and Indochina. Joseph Alsop's fevered reports of largely invented communist military actions were particularly noteworthy. As the Vietnam War escalated, Laos became only the wart on the hog of Vietnam, as Dean Rusk put it, a sideshow war, in Walter Haney's phrase, as Cambodia was to be later on. Media coverage declined as the sideshow war escalated. There were, in fact, three distinct U.S. wars: the bombing of the Ho Chi Minh Trail in the south, the bombing of the Peasant Society of northern Laos, which the U.S. government conceded was unrelated to the war in South Vietnam, and the clandestine war between a CIA-run mercenary force based on mountain tribesmen and the Pathet Lao, backed by North Vietnam apparently at about the level of the Thai and other mercenaries introduced by the United States. The bombing of southern Laos was reported. The clandestine war and the bombing of northern Laos were not, apart from tales about North Vietnamese aggression, often fanciful and subjected to no critical analysis. In July 1968, the Southeast Asia correspondent of Le Monde, Jacques Decanois, published lengthy eyewitness reports of the bombing of northern Laos, which had become a world without noise, for the surrounding villages have disappeared, the inhabitants themselves living hidden in the mountains. It is dangerous to lean out at any time of the night or day because of the ceaseless bombardment that leads to the scientific destruction of the areas held by the enemy. He describes the motionless ruins and deserted houses of the capital of Sam Nui district, first bombed by the U.S. Air Force in February 1965. Much of this population center had been razed to the ground by bombing, and as he arrived, he observed the smoking ruins from recent raids with phosphorus bombs, the enormous craters everywhere in the town, the churches and houses demolished, the remnants of U.S. fragmentation bombs dropped to maximize civilian casualties. From this town to a distance of 30 kilometers, no house in the villages and hamlets had been spared. Bridges had been destroyed. Fields up to the rivers were holed with bomb craters. After Decanois' reports, there could be no doubt that the U.S. Air Force was directing murderous attacks against the Civilian Society of Northern Laos. These reports of terrible destruction were repeatedly brought to the attention of the media, but ignored, or more accurately, suppressed. Later described as secret bombings in an executive war, the U.S. attack was indeed secret, not simply because of government duplicity as charged, but because of press complicity. Not only did the media fail to publish the information about the attack against a defenseless civilian society or seek to investigate further for themselves, but they proceeded to provide exculpatory accounts that they knew to be inaccurate, on the rare occasions when the bombing was mentioned at all. As the bombing of Laos began to be reported in 1969, the claim was that it was targeted against North Vietnamese infiltration routes to South Vietnam, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and later that U.S. planes were providing tactical support to government forces fighting North Vietnamese aggressors, a far cry from what Decanois had witnessed and reported, and a much more tolerable version of the unacceptable facts. Keeping just to the New York Times, through 1968 there was no mention of the bombing apart from tiny items reporting Pathet Lao complaints, December 2nd and 31st, 1968. On May 18, 1969, the Times reported U.S. bombing in Laos, alleging that it was directed against routes, including the so-called Ho Chi Minh Trail, over which the North Vietnamese send men and supplies to infiltrate South Vietnam. A June 14th report states that American planes bomb targets all over Laos, especially along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, in an effort to harass the Pathet Lao, the communist-led rebel movement in Laos, and to stop the flow of enemy supplies to South Vietnam. Charles Moore reported on July 16th that U.S. bombing is directed against infiltration routes from North Vietnam that pass through Laos en route to the south. There is a July 28th reference to 200 American bombing sorties a day over northeastern Laos, directed against North Vietnamese forces, and Hedrick Smith adds from Washington on August 2nd that the United States has been bombing North Vietnamese concentrations in Laos. T.D. Allman, reporting bombing sorties in tactical support of government forces fighting the North Vietnamese and harassing attacks against communist positions all over northeast Laos on August 25th, the latter providing the first glimpse of something beyond the approved version. Further reports of U.S. air power and tactical support and to cut North Vietnamese supply routes appear on September 7th, followed by Allman's report of successes of a government offensive with forces stiffened by Thai soldiers, supported by the most intense American bombing ever seen in Laos, September 18th. Then followed reports from Washington and Vientiane, September 19th, 20th, 23rd, 24th, and 30th, confirming that the U.S. Air Force was providing tactical support for government combat missions in addition to bombing North Vietnamese infiltration routes, including a September 23rd Agence France-Presse dispatch reporting bombing of Pathet Lao areas by United States aircraft, thus implying that the bombing went well beyond infiltration routes and combat operations, common knowledge in Paris and Vientiane, but yet to be reported here. In short, the terror bombing of northern Laos, although known, remained off the agenda, and reporting in general was slight and highly misleading, to say the least. Elterman observes that the war in Laos and Cambodia was virtually invisible in the media through 1969, apart from the leftist National Guardian, which gave substantial coverage to what was in fact happening. On October 1, 1969, the New York Times finally ran an account by T.D. Allman, whose valuable reporting throughout the war appeared primarily overseas, concluding that the rebel economy and social fabric were the main United States targets now, and that the American bombardment had driven the population to caves and tunnels during the daylight hours, making it difficult for the Pathet Lao to fight a people's war with fewer and fewer people. Control of territory was now of lesser importance, he wrote, with United States bombers able to destroy almost at will any given town, bridge, road, or concentration of enemy soldiers or civilians. This confirmation of what had long been known in restricted peace movement circles and consciously suppressed in the mainstream press passed without particular notice. The CIA clandestine army had swept through the Plain of Jars in the preceding months, evacuating all remaining civilians to areas near Vientiane, where they and their harrowing stories were largely ignored by the well-represented media, although available elsewhere. Walter Haney, a Laos-speaking American who compiled a detailed collection of refugee interviews that was described as serious and carefully prepared by U.S. Ambassador to Laos William Sullivan, quotes remarks by a U.N. official in Laos as the most concise account of the bombing. By 1968, the intensity of the bombings was such that no organized life was possible in the villages. The villages moved to the outskirts and then deeper and deeper into the forest as the bombing reached its peak in 1969, when jet planes came daily and destroyed all stationary structures. Nothing was left standing. The villagers lived in trenches and holes or in caves. They only farmed at night. Each of the informants, without any exception, had his village completely destroyed. In the last phase, bombings were aimed at the systematic destruction of the material basis of the civilian society. A staff study by a Kennedy subcommittee concluded that a main purpose of the U.S. bombardment was to destroy the physical and social infrastructure in areas held by the Pathet Lao, a conclusion well supported by the factual record. There were also eyewitness reports of the destruction of northern Laos by Western reporters, but published overseas. T.D. Allman flew over the Plain of Jars in late 1971, reporting that it is empty and ravaged by the napalm and B-52 saturation bombing being used in an attempt to extinguish all human life in the target area. All vegetation has been destroyed, and the craters, literally, are countless, and often impossible to distinguish among the endless patches of churned earth repeatedly bombed. At the same time, the Washington Post published the statement of Air Force Secretary Robert Seamans, who reported from northern Laos that, "I have seen no evidence of indiscriminate bombing. It is the North Vietnamese who are rough, and the people are not against the United States, just the opposite." The Laos-speaking Australian reporter John Everingham traveled in 1970 through dying village after dying village of the Hmong tribesmen who had been naive enough to trust the CIA and were now being offered a one-way copter ride to death in the CIA clandestine army in the remains of a country where bombing had turned more than half the total area of Laos to a land of charred ruins where people fear the sky so that nothing be left standing or alive for the communists to inherit. No U.S. journal, apart from the tiny pacifist press, was interested enough to run his story, although later the media were to bewail the plight of the miserable remnants of the Hmong, put on display as victims of communism. In 1970, the Bangkok World, October 7th, published an AP report on U.S. bombing that was wiping out towns, and by 1972 such reports sometimes appeared in the U.S. press. Later, Nayan Chanda visited the Plain of Jars, reporting overseas that from the air it resembles a lunar landscape, pockmarked as it is with bomb craters that are a stark testimony to the years of war that denuded the area of people and buildings during 6 years of secret bombing by U.S. aircraft, while at ground level, the signs of death and destruction are even more ubiquitous, including the provincial capital completely razed, as had been reported earlier by refugees who were ignored. Following the practice of American volunteers during the war, American relief workers with long experience in Laos attempted to bring information about post-war Laos to the media with little effect and inform us privately that their accounts were seriously distorted by New York Times reporters by the device of omission and taking the negative side of balanced statements we made and similar means. The U.S. government officially denied all of this, continuing the deception even after the facts were exposed and known in some detail to those concerned enough to learn them. Many regarded the U.S. war in Laos as a success, Senators Jacob Javits and Stuart Symington, or even a spectacular success, a former CIA officer in Laos, Thomas McCoy. In Scale and Care, the extensive analysis of refugee reports by a few young American volunteers in Laos compares very favorably to the subsequent studies of refugees from Cambodia that received massive publicity in the West after the Khmer Rouge takeover, and the story was both gruesome and highly pertinent to ongoing U.S. operations. But there was little interest, and published materials, which appeared primarily outside of the mainstream, were virtually ignored and quickly forgotten. The agency of terror was inappropriate for the needs of the doctrinal system. Media failure to report the facts when they were readily available in 1968 and to investigate further when they were undeniable by late 1969 contributed to the successful deception of the public and to the continuing destruction. When the war ended, ABC News commentator Harry Reasoner expressed his hope that Laos and its gentle folk could return to peaceful ways after the clowning of the CIA and the vicious invasion of the North Vietnamese. The clowning of the CIA included the destruction of the rebel economy and social fabric in northern Laos, with unknown numbers killed in areas that may never recover, and the decimation of the Hmong who were enlisted in the CIA cause and then abandoned when no longer useful. Nothing remotely comparable may be attributed to the vicious invasion of the North Vietnamese, which did, however, include such atrocities as killing 12 U.S. Air Force men in March 1968 at a U.S. radar base near the North Vietnamese border, used to direct the bombing of North Vietnam and operations in North Vietnam by U.S.-led mercenaries. The New York Times reviewed the war in Laos at the war's end, concluding that 350,000 people had been killed, over a tenth of the population, with another tenth uprooted in this fratricidal strife that was increased to tragic proportions by warring outsiders. The fratricidal strife might well have been terminated by the 1958 coalition government had it not been for outsiders, with the United States playing a decisive role throughout, a role completely ignored in this purported historical analysis apart from a few misleading comments. At this late date, the Times continued to pretend that the U.S. bombing was directed against North Vietnamese supply trails. Nothing else is mentioned. The crucial events of the actual history also disappear or are grossly misrepresented. Subsequent reporting also regularly obliterated the U.S. role in creating the devastation and post-war problems attributed to the communists alone, a shameful evasion in the light of the undisputed historical facts. Once again, the media record, less than glorious, is well explained throughout by the propaganda model. 6.2. Cambodia. 6.2.1. The Decade of the Genocide. Few countries have suffered more bitterly than did Cambodia during the 1970s. The Decade of the Genocide, as the period is termed in the Finnish Inquiry Commission that attempted to assess what had taken place, consisted of three phases, now extending the time scale to the present, which bears a heavy imprint of these terrible years. Phase 1, from 1969 through April 1975, U.S. bombing at a historically unprecedented level and a civil war sustained by the United States left the country in utter ruins. Though Congress legislated an end to the bombing in August 1973,